Hey, I'm Josh, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Josh.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks to the committee. Thank you for asking me to do this. This may give you an example of how I'm an alcoholic. When Sean was up here talking about how great Matt was, I immediately thought, well, damn, he didn't say anything about me. I took that personally. And that's my alcoholism as it stands today. You know, I take everything personally in an impersonal world. My sobriety date is December 17th of 2019, so I've got about 3 years, 4 months, and a few weeks. I got sober slightly before the pandemic came, and I was one of the lucky ones who had a little baseline of early sobriety when the pandemic came. And that's my sobriety date. I have a sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. He and I have regular communication. I have a grand sponsor who's pretty active in meetings that I go to. I sponsor men. I've got a home group. Any of you looking for a men's meeting on Saturday morning, 9 o'clock, St. Luke's? It's a pretty big meeting. And I know technically I probably shouldn't have more than one home group, but I have a co-ed meeting on Wednesday nights that I also consider a home group, Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at Tillman. And I'm there on Saturdays and Wednesdays unless I'm out of town or I have some other commitment that I can't go. But they take priority in my life. I will start a little bit at the beginning, I guess. I was reared in South Florida. I grew up in a town west of West Palm Beach called Wellington. It was a nice community. But from an early age, I think we moved there when I was about 8. We were sort of poor family in a nice area. So right off the bat, I had that same feeling of different that a lot of us have. And that's not unique to alcoholics. A lot of young kids and young people feel different from their peers, but a lot of them grow out of that. They don't have to turn to alcohol to change the way they feel. My parents got divorced when I was probably 10 or 11. They worked very hard, provided me everything I needed and pretty much everything I wanted. And looking back, I wasn't grateful at all at the time. I just looked to what other people had. I thought about how I didn't have certain things that some of my friends had. So I had this feeling of, you know, I deserved better, I wanted more, I was inadequate because I didn't have enough. And that was sort of the foundation of my life. One of the great things that my parents did, though, was stress education. Neither of them had college degrees, so they felt it was very important that I get a good education, work hard, and that was something that they sort of ingrained in me early on. Like a lot of people, and this is not a reason why I'm an alcoholic, you know, I had a traumatic event happen to me when I was 8 or 9. I was a victim of, unfortunately, things that happened to little kids by an older cousin. And while that did not make me an alcoholic, that helped cloud my perception on how to interact with girls or women. It clouded my perception on feelings of what I thought about myself. It helped me view the world as a very negative place. So from an early age, 8 or 9, I was one of those glass half empty people. You know, I was a pessimist. I had friends that were optimists. That just wasn't me. I worked hard. I did well in school. I tried to make you like me. And what I mean by that is I had friends across all genres of middle school and high school. I was good in sports. I was good in debate. I was smart. So I was friendly with the nerds, the jocks, the band people, the debate people, all of them. I could be exactly what they needed me to be for them to like me. So I became a pretty good actor at an early age. I was perceptive enough to pick up on what people wanted from me, and I typically gave it to them. And I don't mean physical things, but I just mean the way they wanted me to act. And that sort of set the stage for me for the rest of my life. Well, an active addiction. I was, I guess, and I didn't know this at the time, a people pleaser. I wanted you to like me. I heard somebody share at a meeting the other day about fear, and I never heard this until, I guess it was actually yesterday. He said, you know, today he has fear of not getting something he wants, fear of losing something that he has, and the other thing I'd never heard about that kind of resonated with is fear of what you all think of me. And that was me. I worried about what people thought of me. I wanted you to like me. I wanted you to think highly of me. If you didn't like me, I would do what I could to make you like me. And this is stuff that I'm doing before I ever had a drink. That is my disease of alcoholism. That's how it manifested itself very early on. My parents didn't really drink. I was talking to somebody last night about this, and I'm not really sure where I heard this, but I don't remember seeing either side of my grandparents ever take a drink. I think on my dad's side, maybe somewhere back down the line, there was an alcoholic or an alcohol-related incident. But I remember when my friends started to drink, and you know, maybe when I was 14 or 15, my parents had said, "Yeah, you know, you really probably shouldn't drink. There's something," and I don't remember what it is. You know, in our lineage. So I don't know if I have an alcoholic gene, but I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. My mother was very loving. My father did the best he could. He was loving, but in a way that just didn't mesh with me. And my father and I now have a great relationship, but for a long time we didn't. And that was me. It's not because he didn't want a relationship. It's because I had to choose the terms to allow him in. But I didn't have any of that alcoholic behavior from family members. I didn't have the chaos in my house. I didn't have a lot of the things that I hear people talk about when they share their story. But I had that feeling of being different, of feeling different, of feeling like I didn't fit in, of being that chameleon to be who I thought you wanted me to be. I was also, you know, I guess, I don't like this term, but I'll say it anyway, a goody-goody. You know, I was that good kid. I was the kid that on the outside I looked really, really good. I was the kid that other parents said, "Why can't you be more like Josh?" That's all external stuff. That wasn't how I felt on the inside. And I think many of us know that, you know, we're able to paint this glowing picture on the outside. But on the inside, for me, I felt horrible. I felt inadequate. I felt like I didn't belong. I felt different. And I didn't know what to do to feel any better. Early on, before I ever had a driver's license, you know, my friends were drinking, and I was the kid that would drive them to and from parties. I didn't have a car, I didn't have a license, but I wasn't drinking. And I did that for about 6 months. And then finally I decided that maybe I would want to have a drink. I guess I should back up. I think I had a sip of my dad's beer at age 9 or 10. I don't remember anything from it. I don't think I liked the taste of it. But it wasn't one of those things where the first sip I knew I was hooked. That wasn't my experience. But what my experience became when I first started drinking, and it was probably a keg party out in a field when I was in high school, was me with a beer or two in me. Oh my God, I was such a better version of me. All that fear, all that anxiety sort of melted away. I could talk to girls. I didn't feel so inadequate. I didn't feel so insecure. I felt better. I joked for a long time that the best version of me was me on two or three drinks. And that's really how I felt. And for a while, alcohol worked for me. I mean, as we know, alcohol was a solution to my inner turmoil. To me, it was a solution to my restlessness, my irritability, my discontent. When I drank, I got that ease and comfort that came at once. I felt better. I belonged. I'll admit one of the few things that I couldn't do, and I think it's appropriate, is I never could sing. I never had any delusion when I was drinking or drunk that I could karaoke. So I will definitely not be doing that tonight sober. But generally when I drank, I felt better. In high school, I was a pretty good basketball player, and I used to play not only for the high school team, but I played with older guys that were 18, 19, 20, 21, and they had a townhouse right near the park, and they used to buy us beer, and we'd go over there, we'd play cards, we'd play basketball, play cards, drink beer, and do whatever. And that became what I would do on most Friday and Saturday nights when I was about a junior in high school. And for the most part, there was no consequence. My senior year of high school, I think I came home. I didn't have a curfew because I was a good kid. I'd always be home on time or call my mom if it was going to be, you know, later than a reasonable hour. But that one time I didn't do it, my mom was sitting there on the stairs, and I still remember it. I remember it for three reasons. Number one, my mom had never done that. She was waiting up for me. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning. Number two, I was so hungover I couldn't play in the game the next afternoon. We had a tournament. And number three, and this is horrible to admit, especially on tape, it was the first time I kissed a girl. I mean, I remember that. I remember staying up waiting for this girl who was older to make a move because I was too shy, and I had to maintain that perfect amount of alcohol to still be charming but not be too drunk. So I didn't really have much in the way of consequences. I, you know, used alcohol periodically before basketball games, periodically before debate tournaments, because again, me on two beers was a better, or two drinks was a better version of me. I played better. I wasn't drinking beer at that point. What I used to do, and it's kind of embarrassing, is for those of you that remember wine coolers, and this is in the late 80s, early 90s, I used to take two wine coolers that were pretty, you know, they tasted good, drink them as fast as I could, and I felt better. And that's what I would do before a debate tournament. That's what I do before some basketball games. And the results work. I mean, I did better. I played better. I mean, it benefited me. And that was my experience with alcohol. I am generally respectful of singleness of purpose. Unfortunately, I'm not a pure alcoholic. I will try to minimize my talking about outside issues. But that was part of my story. And ultimately, that's what got me in here quicker probably than if I was still just drinking. But I had dabbled in outside issues in high school, and it wasn't a big deal. But when I started to drink more that my senior year of high school and started to make some silly decisions about life based on alcohol, that was sort of the, looking back, one of the first things I noticed was, you know, I chose a place to go to college based on drinking age. I don't know if it's David here. I don't see him. He and I were talking last night. I went to Tulane, which is in New Orleans. When I went there, the drinking age was 18, didn't need a fake ID. It was really, really easy. And that's where my drinking escalated. My freshman year, I was, you know, going to Bourbon Street pretty much every weekend. I was drinking 5-6 nights a week to as a hard drinker to excess. But I was still able to wake up and go to class and get good grades. And that was my experience both at high school and in college. I could, you know, have fun, drink hard, but not have any negative consequences. And that's just kind of the way it worked for me. Didn't have really any negative consequences. I say that, and then, of course, I remember that. I got put on probation in college for drinking. I guess I forgot about that. And then I remember I was on probation for drinking for an alcohol-related incident, and then I had another alcohol-related incident. And I remember that was probably the first time that I went to an alcohol counselor and thought that maybe I did drink too much. But instead of slowing down my drinking or going to AA, which I don't think I knew about, I decided that I needed to not drink on campus anymore. I needed to drink secretly off campus so I couldn't get caught. And that's what I did. I had great grades in college, graduated early. I was fortunate enough to go back and teach high school at the high school I went to. I was 20 years old teaching high school. Wasn't able to drink legally in Florida, but I was able to go to a bar where I knew people who assumed I was old enough to drink because I was a high school teacher and continued to drink the way I wanted to drink. That wasn't my career path. That was something that I knew was going to be a short-term thing. I came to Atlanta, I went to graduate school, and the same thing. I was able to get good grades and drink the way I wanted to drink all through graduate school and not have any real consequences. I, in Atlanta, had my law school friends and I had my other friends, and I would drink with my law school friends on certain nights of the week and my other friends, and this is back pre-Ray Lewis when Buckhead was a lot of fun. I'd go to Buckhead with my other friends, and they didn't see me drinking that way for 4 or 5 nights a week. They would just see me, you know, 1 or 2 nights, and the other friends would see me 1 or 2 nights. So I was hiding the way I drank because I knew it was a little excessive. I also, this is back in the mid to late 90s, I was doing that. I was dabbling in some outside issues, nothing too serious, but I was having a lot of fun. I was a, you know, mid-20s something man in Atlanta, and it was a lot of fun. But I started to see my friends, you know, settle down and start getting wives and maybe have kids, and I decided that I needed to try to do that too. So at that time, I think I was one of those hard drinkers that our big book talks about. And I think the hard drinker, what it says on page 20, or 21, it says, certain type of hard drinker, he may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man could also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome, and may even need medical attention. I met a girl who didn't really drink, and it was a woman that I ended up marrying. And so I needed to grow up and be an adult and get into a normal relationship, and I couldn't drink the way I used to drink, especially because she didn't really drink. And that's what I did. I don't think I had crossed that invisible line into full-blown alcoholism by that point. But for the next 15 years, I would dabble as a social drinker, a social user of outside issues, and not really have any consequences. But the problem is that I was not me. I was not living a truthful life. I was still playing a role to this woman, who's now my ex-wife, trying to be the man that I thought she needed me to be. I was unable to have an honest relationship with her. I was unable to have a healthy relationship with her. I was living with lots of guilt and shame, which I drank at occasionally, which was eating me up on the inside most of the time, and which caused problems. In around 2017, so about 2 years before I got sober, I was just driving, and I decided that I want wings. And I went to a restaurant that in my mid-20s I used to go to and play trivia and watch football and drink like a normal person at. And I went there and was watching football and eating wings and had, you know, one or two beers. And I met a guy, you know, sitting next to me, and we became fast friends. And he was fun to hang out with, and he drank the way I wanted to drink. So I would find excuses to go hang out with him and watch games or eat wings and start drinking the way that I really wanted to drink. And that's that last 2 years is when my drinking got way out of control. He was the man, he was the type of guy that if ever I wanted to drink, he would always say yes. I knew where he would be, and he was a regular, you know, he would bounce from bar to bar on Roswell Road. He was a sort of regular at a number of different bars. And I remember that he had been in and out of AA for about 15 years, and he's now sober. He's got about 3 months less than I do right now, time. But he had been in and out of AA for a while, and I saw the way he drank, and he said to me, "Hey, you may want to come to an AA meeting with me." I said, "What? Makes no sense." But he had also, you know, I couldn't keep up with him. He's a very large man. He's about 6'5", 315, you know, just muscular, real big built guy. And he drank way more than I could drink. So he also sort of turned me on. And it's not something that I hadn't done. But he had, thank you. He had turned me on to some substances that would help me drink longer and stay up longer. And sort of, if I got too drunk, it would make me feel a little bit less drunk. And I really liked that substance a lot. And that just helped me drink the way I wanted to drink. But that got me in here a lot more quickly. But I remember him saying, not just one night, on multiple nights, you know, having those drunken conversations in a bar, "Hey man, we're drinking too much, we're doing this too much, maybe we should go to AA, maybe you should come with me to AA." And to me that resonated a little bit because I saw how he drank. And for him to think that maybe I needed AA, I may have a problem. But I didn't go. Because I didn't want to go. I wasn't ready. So that was about a year he and I were doing that. But he kept bugging me about going to a meeting. He took me to a meeting, the first meeting I ever went to. And, of course, I didn't pick up a chip. It was on a Monday night. I was heavily under the influence, but you wouldn't know by looking at me. Well, I didn't think anyone would know by looking at me. And I was sitting in the back, and it was a big book study, and I didn't understand anything because, quite honestly, I didn't know anything about AA. I guess I should back up. When I was young, I was religious. And, you know, our big book talks about the wrongdoings of others, real or perceived. I had an issue, and I went to my youth pastor, and he blew me off. I don't know if that's really what happened, but that's what I thought happened. So I was what somebody I've heard say is called church burned. I had no relationship with a higher power. I didn't want to see the word God on the steps. I did not want anything that had to do with the word G-O-D. So when we went to that AA meeting and, you know, I see, you know, God multiple times on the wall, that just wasn't for me. or I didn't think it was for me. And that was on a Monday, and he'd always told me about the Saturday morning men's meeting at St. Luke's, and I'd never be up at 9 a.m. on a Saturday to go to it. But that same Saturday, he took me to that meeting. And unlike that meeting on Monday night where I was under the influence and looking around and seeing nothing but differences, I walked into that Saturday morning men's meeting bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, kind of. But I looked for some similarities, and I saw, okay, maybe if I want to get sober, maybe I could come back here. I saw something that didn't push me away or scare me or send me away. The funny part about that, and I've shared this before, is that the parking lot there at St. Luke's is right next to the apartment complex where my outside issues dealer used to live. So I'd been in that parking lot a lot of times over the past, you know, the prior year, but I'd never actually gone into St. Luke's until that Saturday. That was probably January of 2019. My buddy got sober. Again, he'd been in and out for like 15 years, and I remember him saying that he was sober, and I didn't want to be a bad influence, so I decided I couldn't, you know, ask him to go out and drink with me. So what I did was what most good alcoholics do towards the end of their drinking career. I started drinking at home. Then I could drink at home the way I wanted to drink, do at home what I wanted to do, and hide what I was doing from my then wife, because, you know, if she saw how much I was drinking or doing the other things, she wouldn't have been particularly happy. And that's what I did for that last year. And that last year was absolutely miserable. You know, when I think about unmanageability, you know, I've been to meetings where I hear people talk about arrests and DUIs and losing jobs and being homeless and losing families and losing bankruptcies and all these things. And don't get me wrong, that's unmanageability, but that wasn't my story of unmanageability. What I felt was that internal unmanageability. I felt hopeless. I wanted to not live the way I was living, but I had no idea how I could stop it. I had no idea where to turn for help. Wasn't really sure I wanted help. I didn't want to live. I didn't particularly want to kill myself, but I didn't really want to live. And it was an awful feeling. And at that last year or so, I was chasing all those years that alcohol worked for me, that alcohol and any other outside issue worked for me. I was chasing what used to be a solution for me, and it just wasn't. It was miserable. Some people, you know, if we go back to the literature a little bit, I'm sorry, I like to read a little bit from the big book because I like the big book. The big book, and I'll get to the solution soon, has solved all my problems. I mean, what I learned in this program, in this book, and this is a design for living. It's not just, hey, get sober. But I like the paragraph in chapter 11, A Vision for You, and it's some great writing. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself, as we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that his loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. When I first read that, it sent chills up my spine because that was what it was like at the end. I could not feel better. My solution that had been a solution for 30 years was no longer a solution. I was miserable and I didn't know what to do. So I suffered like that through 2019, all the while on the outside, you know, having a smile on my face, performing well at job, I mean, well at work. Nobody would know. But I would get home from work. I would drink. I would do other stuff. I would then have to take something else to go to sleep. I'd wake up and do it all over again. And as the end came near, that mental obsession, the when can I start this process again, started happening where I was like, how early can I leave work? How early can I, you know, do what I want to do and not get caught? My marriage at that point was failing. I'd moved into a second bedroom. And what I used to do was, you know, stay up and drink and do other things to help me stay regulated and go down these rabbit holes. My obsessive mind was just, it would obsess about the craziest things. And I would just stay up and obsess about things, and that's what I was doing. But somehow, in December of 2019, and looking back, it could only be a moment of grace. I had the idea that maybe I needed to go get some help somewhere. I still didn't really like AA, didn't really like the God thing, but where could I go? Maybe I needed rehab. Maybe like an IOP might work, but no, IOP would be local. I'd have to live at home, and that wasn't going to work out. So maybe I needed to go to rehab for a little bit of time and get outside of the city of Atlanta, and maybe that would work. And that's what I did. But being an important person, I wasn't going to a 28-day program or a 30-day program. I had a shop program, so I found one that said, sure, you could come for 2 weeks, because that's what I needed. I only had 2 weeks to give them. And I went to a program in Augusta, and when I got there, I looked around, and, you know, like a lot of alcoholics, I was way too good for the people in that program. You know, I thought very highly of myself. That program, you know, the counselors had no experience. They were teaching down to the lowest common denominator. That wasn't me. I was smart. You know, I got all this stuff going on in my life, so that wasn't going to work for me. But I got a little bit of a foundation, and it sounds like sometimes when I talk about this, I'm knocking rehab, and I'm not. Because that got me away. But I left after 11 days. And let me back up. I picked up a white chip in Augusta. They took me to one outside AA meeting, and I got to pick up my white chip in Augusta. And that really meant a lot to me. Because at that meeting, it was Christmas Eve of 2019. It was, I guess it's called a popcorn meeting. I've never seen it since. But where they had different people come up and talk about, I've got, you know, 30 years, and this is why my life's so much better. And then 5 minutes later, they picked somebody else. It was really amazing. But that gave me the insight that maybe I needed to try AA again, or try AA for real, I should say. Came back to Atlanta. You know, it wasn't AMA. It was something. I left rehab. They're like, hey, you're going to fail. You know, people that leave rehab typically are going to relapse. But if you don't relapse, you come back and tell your story in a year. And as any good alcoholic, I was like, well, spite will keep me sober. So I left there with a little bit of spite, and obviously spite will not keep me sober, but I had enough spite to say, okay, I'm going to go to an IOP. I showed up at IOP, that was a Saturday, I showed up to IOP on Monday, and they're like, what are you doing? You can't just show up. You know, you've got to like apply, you got to get in, and they're like, okay. So I ended up going to an IOP, but what I did that was really, really smart was that Saturday I left rehab, I came straight to an AA meeting. And at that time, I lived in Virginia Highlands, so the only place I knew, I had one friend who'd gotten sober 12 or 13 years before, and he went to the Galano Club, which is right there in Midtown. And I went to the Galano Club, and I still didn't like the word God, and Galano Club, believe it or not, had a We Agnostic meeting. I think they still do. So Tuesdays, Fridays, and Sundays, you would see me at that We Agnostic meeting, where I saw people who had, I think the long time of there, had 24 years of sobriety, and they weren't talking about God. And that worked for me in the beginning. I went, you know, I still heard, get a sponsor. So I started going to meetings all over the place looking for a sponsor. And I think it's funny, maybe it's not, but I had a hard time asking a guy to be my sponsor. You know, I thought back to being a high school kid trying to ask a girl out, and that just wasn't me. I couldn't do it. So I remember being at a Monday morning meeting it's kind of an offshoot of that St. Luke's men's meeting. And I finally just raised my head and said, hey, you know, I've got, I don't know what I had, 30 days sobriety or whatever. How do I get a sponsor? And two guys gave me their phone numbers. And I had a sponsor that afternoon. And it was a guy that I'd heard share who had what I wanted. He was younger than me, but I liked the way he shared. He shared about the solution. He was very regimented in what he did. And I needed that. I needed somebody to not suggest, but tell me what to do. And I heard a speaker, and I don't remember who it was, say this. Yeah, you know, my suggestions, there are no suggestions in AA, sure. Suggestions in AA are kind of like the suggestion that you wear a parachute when you jump outside of the plane. I mean, you just got to do it. And he told me things that I didn't want to hear and I didn't believe in, but he was sober, and the guys in his sponsorship lineage were sober, and the guys at this meeting were sober, and if this worked for them, maybe it worked for me. I didn't have anything to lose at that point. So I did it. And he's, you know, real big about hitting your knees and praying. I'm like, well, what am I praying to? Like, I don't believe in God. What am I going to pray to? Because I don't know. Just pray to something other than you to help keep you sober. And that's how it started for me. Many of us have, I assume most of us have read the We Agnostics. And I had that willingness. I had the willingness to do what was suggested of me. And as I started to go through the book with a sponsor, as I started to do what was suggested of me, then I started to feel tangible results of feeling better. That's what I needed. Okay, if I went to AA and didn't feel better, I wouldn't have stuck around. I really wouldn't have. I had a sponsor who was able to take me through the steps pretty much as quickly as I wanted to go through the steps. And I wanted to go fast because I needed relief. I know some people don't do it that way, and great, that may work for them. But if I didn't feel relief, I would have been back out the door. And I remember struggling a lot with step two and the higher power concepts. And he gave me the book, Came to Believe. He said, read all the stories in Came to Believe. Read the stories in the back of the big book. You know, we'll talk about this. And he also kind of was agnostic-ish. So that I think that helped. But I believed in a power greater than myself. I believed that I wasn't God. And that's all I needed. I just needed that willingness to start out. And, you know, step three I struggled with because I couldn't understand how me, who was able to control life fairly well for so long, was going to give up my control of everything. I didn't really understand that. But I kept trying. And one day it occurred to me that just think about it like being in a car. I don't always have to drive. I could sometimes sit. I didn't say the back seat. I could sit in the passenger seat. And that kind of was the start that I needed. And I remember going to IOP one day shortly after that. And apparently I was wound very tight. I didn't know that. But I had people that had seen me 3 times a week for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 weeks say, you look different. There's something different about you. And that was really, really exciting for me. Because I had people who I'd started to get to know and like who saw a change in me. And that meant that I was getting better. And what happens if this is working for me? I just sort of jump further in. So unlike some people, I jumped into my 4th step, was happy to do it, did my 5th step with my sponsor, happy to do it. But I, of course, had that list of things I was going to tell them, the list of things I might tell them, and the list of things I wasn't telling any human being. And he was smart enough or savvy enough or whatever you call it to have us meet a couple, I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 times, where I was able to tell him some of those things, and he would share some things with me. And all those things that I thought I did that were so horrible, they weren't all that horrible. He had done them. Other guys we knew had done them. They weren't that horrible. I started to learn about guilt and shame and that, you know, just because I may have done something bad, that didn't make me a bad person. And I was able to identify that, you know, what I did isn't who I am. And as we did that first meeting, I then became more willing to share other stuff with him. And then, I shared this recently. He saw me tell my story, I don't know, 2, 3 months ago. And he came up to me afterwards and said, Josh, I don't know if you remember this, but that when I kind of got these 2 big things off my chest, he said, when you did that, I visibly saw your demeanor changed, like this burden was lifted when I was able to get rid of some of those, to tell him some of those things. And he had never told me that. And this is about 2.5 years later that he told me that. And that was huge. And that's how I felt. That was the tangible result of feeling better that I needed from doing a 5th step. So I continued to work the steps. You know, I worked 6 and 7, 8 and 9. I've made all but 2 amends. I keep saying all but 2 amends. It feeels like I've said that for 2.5 years. I have 2 amends I still need to make. And I'm willing, but I think it may cause harm. So my sponsor and I keep talking about whether I'm going to do it or not. But then I got to get to the 10th step. And the 10th step is sort of the magic, in my opinion, where all the magic happens, right? So for me, I didn't understand AA when I came in. I thought I was going to learn how to drink like a normal person. I have no idea why I thought that. I thought I was intelligent, but I just had no idea. Has anyone seen this show on TV, Mom? That's what I thought AA was. That's how ignorant I was when I came in, all right? And then I quickly learned it's a program of entire abstinence, that I'd never drink again. And that doesn't really bother me, or didn't really bother me in the beginning. But I quickly learned, I'm sorry, I should back up. My obsession was lifted when I did that 5th step. My obsession to drink, to use other substances, that was lifted like that when I did my 5th step. And then I quickly learned that this program is, tip of the iceberg is alcohol. Not drinking, tip of the iceberg, right? I didn't know that. I've heard a speaker talk about, you know, people that just don't drink and don't do anything else, don't really work the steps, they don't drink, that's great. But it's like going to the greatest buffet in the world and eating like a crouton. I mean, it's just, there's so much more to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous than just not drinking. And that's what my grand sponsor talks about a lot. He is a big proponent of, if you never leave the basics, you don't have to get back to the basics. I still go to a lot of meetings, probably 4 to 7 a week. Just depends on my schedule, but I plug them in. I'm lazy. If they're not in my calendar, I'm not going. So everything is plugged into my calendar. I do the exact same things I did in the beginning. I stay in those basics. I hit my knees every morning. I have a set list of prayers that I do, and it sometimes changes, but generally it's Serenity Prayer, Third Step Prayer, Seventh Step Prayer, Prayer of St. Francis, sort of what I call the morning prayer that's taken straight from, I forget what page it is, 86 or 87 in the big book. And that's what I do every morning. My grand sponsor's big about talking out to your higher power like he's your best friend. You'll see me, you won't see me, but as I'm driving, I'm talking out loud to somebody other than me like he's a friend. I still don't know exactly what my higher power is, but it doesn't matter. It's not me. I look back over my life and I see ample examples of some guiding force outside of me has helped me a lot. Some guiding force has helped me stay sober. Some guiding force has helped me stay sane. And that brings us to, I guess, 10 and 11. I mean, 10 is, you know, 10 is 4 through 9, like that. You know, it's how we get to grow spiritually. I hate when I hear people say, oh yeah, 10, 11, 12, they're the maintenance steps. Well, if I'm maintaining, that's not real good for me. I'm going to be a jerk pretty quickly. I need to keep growing. And I don't do this program perfectly by any stretch of the imagination. I started to tell you all what I do each day. I still don't meditate worth a darn. Although, this week, I've been challenged to meditate twice a day for 7 minutes, and I've done it, what day is today, Saturday? I think I was started on Wednesday. I did it like 2 times. I mean, I'm not doing it well, but I'm trying. The meditation's the biggest part that I don't do. I work with other guys. I stay in the literature. I have what some people may call guardrail sobriety. I set up these bumpers, like at a bowling alley. I set up my life so I'm making sure that I do certain things. Because if I don't do them, I'm lazy. If I don't do them, I've heard lots of relapse stories, especially with guys, from guys, and mostly men that I'm talking about, with a lot of time, 20 plus years. And every time I hear the same thing, what they stop doing, they stop praying, they stop calling their sponsors, they stop going to meetings, they stop reading literature. The things they stop doing are those basics that I have to do each day. I talk to my sponsor probably a couple times a week. It's not every day. I work with other guys. I am really, really lazy. The way I read my daily readings, anyone wants this email, it's called Daily Ponderables. I forget the guy's name in Tennessee. It's like 7 or 8 different readings he combines together. It's an email. I mean, there's no way that I could argue that I don't have time to read an email because that's what I do all day. So I do that. And that's what's keeping me sane, is by doing each of these things. I don't know what exactly it is that I do that keeps me sane, but if I'm not sane, if the voices inside my head, and I'm not sure if anybody else has these voices, start yapping, that chatter inside my head gets too loud, there's only 3 things that I know that will solve that problem. Or that will change that. Drinking, I'm sorry, 4 things. Drinking, drugging, killing myself, or leaning into the AA program. And every single time I struggle with anything at all, if I lean into the program, I feel better. I'm going to read a little bit. I have a couple quotes that I really want to read. I like to say, you know, that there's some quotes from the big book I want to talk about because I view the AA program as a design for living. It's a solution to all my problems. It's not just a solution to my drinking problem. Bill Wilson, you know, on page 52, talking about the bedevilments, I mean, that's emotional sobriety, right? Emotional sobriety is the next frontier. I need to go through life each day and stay emotionally sober. Otherwise, I will probably not be physically sober. But I'd like to point out a few just quotes, you know, in the chapter to the wives, page 116, if God could solve the age-old riddle of alcoholism, he could solve your problems too. From More About Alcoholism on page 42, quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. On page 19, we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. From page 45, and we agnostics, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously, but where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And then the part of the bedevilments on page 52, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. My life before Alcoholics Anonymous was delusional. I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. I think about the story in the big book about the whiskey and the milk, and there's a definition shortly after that about what is insanity. And how can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? That's my insanity. I can't think straight. Of course, I skipped over step 12, which is the most important step. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, right? So how do I have a spiritual awakening? I do the work. It's very simple. And what is a spiritual awakening? You know, ideas, emotions, and attitudes that were once the guiding force of our lives are sort of cast aside. What does that actually mean to me? It means that I view life differently. I no longer see life like this. My perception has a filter with some God consciousness through it. And when I see things differently, I quickly learn, for just like I said before, that Sean was not slighting me. I don't have to take things personally that have nothing to do with me. Okay? Selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of our problem, right? We all, or not all of us, but that's my problem. The problem I have centers in my mind. And if I do this work and I have a spiritual experience and I view the world differently, my mind does not change the way, my mind is able to see things more accurately. One of my grand sponsor's favorite sayings is, if we change the way we look at things, the things we look at change. That is what a spiritual experience has done to me. Since I've been sober, life has just gotten better. I'm able to be my true, authentic, real self. I don't have to hide any parts of me. I'm able to be open and honest with men. I've gotten married again to a woman who's not one of us, but who has a brain that thinks similarly to us. It's a brain that's kind of obsessive and running a lot. We're able to talk about things. My brain misinterprets things, and instead of creating stories, I get to say, hey, did you mean this? Or what did you mean by that comment? Versus all the stories that my crazy brain used to create. Crazy brain used to create that would cause me in the past to drink. Life has gotten really good. I, in early sobriety, was told that service is really important, and I'll kind of wrap it up with this. I'm a big proponent of the three sides of the triangle. You know, we've got recovery, which is working the steps. We've got fellowship, or unity, which is the fellowship of going to AA meetings. And we've got the service aspect, and service could be in so many different ways. We've got a taper, we've got committee chair, we've got people putting this organization together. We've got some of us talking to each other. That's service. It doesn't always have to be working with people. We've got intergroup. We've got all kinds of opportunities for service. And what does service do? It gets me outside of my own crazy brain. Anytime I'm struggling with anything, the first thing I do is pray to a God I don't believe in, and things typically get better. The second thing that I do, if that doesn't work, is pick up the phone and call another human being and say, hey, how's your day going? 100% of the time, if I call somebody else and say, hey, how's your day going? Whatever it is I was obsessing about, whatever it is I was getting spun up in my own head about, immediately evaporates. It immediately goes away. Yeah, being a good alcoholic, I don't do that right away. I struggle. I sit in that self-pity. I sit in that self-delusion for a little while. I have the solutions to all my problems today, and that's what AA has given me. Thanks for letting me share.